think is to die, literally. Because on June the 11th, 1951, I was pronounced dead of an overdose of a drug called alcohol. Why I'm here is by the grace of God. Just imagine. 29 years ago, the 11th of June, I would have been dead of alcoholism. My sister Evelyn, the one I told you about that was so talented and so beautiful, Jean took me to the cemetery yesterday. My sister died of alcoholism. Look at that tombstone. Look at that date. I was 3 years sober. I tried to help my sister. She wouldn't listen. She didn't have 2 days back-to-back sobriety. She died. She blew apart. Bled to death from alcoholism. Cirrhosis of the liver. Why? She's a talented one. She was beautiful. She was a skier. She was a radio singer. Why'd she die? Because she fought. She kept on fighting. The doctor told her if she drank, she'd die. And she said, I'll tell you what, you quit drinking and I'll quit drinking. I gave up and I won and I lived. If you fight, dear ones, you'll die. It's the only thing in the world. When you come in here, you got to surrender, throw in the towel, and you win. Your family said to you, as my family said to me, for God's sake, Dottie, don't be a quitter. If at first you don't succeed, try again. Keep on fighting. Keep on pushing. In this program, you come in here and you keep on fighting, you keep on pushing, and you will die or go insane. You throw in the towel, get out of the boxing ring, hang up the gloves, and you will win. You know, there's a lot of paradoxes in here. They'll say, easy does it, and they'll say, action's a magic word. Oh, my God, you know, they'll throw you out of your mind. But this one thing I ask you to do is surrender at depth. Quit fighting. The book says we cease to fight everything and everybody, including alcohol. The only fight I ever give up is alcohol. Many times I fight people and things, not as much as I used to. Well, the doctor sedated me all night long. I can remember coming out of this thing and taking bitter-tasting medicine and waking up the next morning, looking in the mirror, not being able to even see the slits in my eyes. My face swelled. You talk about poison, yeah. Alcohol's a poison to me. I went back to the doctor a couple days later, and he said, I want you to listen to me, girl. You can see how long ago that was. He called me girl. He said, if you ever drink again, you'll die. Why you're here, I don't know. But you're as dead as any patient I've ever examined. My first thought that went through my mind is, why didn't he let me go? Geez, I had my perfect out. I was afraid to kill myself because I was so afraid of God. But I had my perfect out, and he brought me back. The next thought that went through my mind, there must be something God wants me to do. There must be something. And so I committed myself that morning. It must have been about June the 13th, 1951. And I said, all right, Lord, I don't understand how it's your will. But I will do this. I will never be too tired or too busy to answer a call for anyone. Just use me all the days of my life. He's never failed, and it's been the easiest commitment I've ever made. I drive between 1,000 and 1,500 miles a month down my way making talks. You think that's hard? People say, how do you do it? Don't you get tired? Oh, I get beautifully tired. I get wonderfully tired. I get lovingly tired. And I'll tell you this, if you hear about me dying, you know I didn't rust out. I may wear out, but I won't rust out. I love it. I love every minute of it. To think that Dottie Shore is not a big blob taking up space anymore. And perhaps this world will be a better place because I came through. And you know, each one in this room today, if you've reached your hand out to help another alcoholic, this world is a better place because you came across it. How many people die and never leave a hole? Never leave a hole. They just die and they were here and you don't even know they're gone. Oh, let's make it count for us, huh? As long as there's an alcoholic out there who's still suffering and we've got a message, we can do it. It really works beautifully. Well, I went back to AA, and the days became months, and months became years, the years came along, and I'm now 29 years and a couple months sober. You've got to know that's a miracle. I never did anything successful in my life. Never completed anything. Great enthusiast. You know, start out with a bang. And then, oh, geez, forget it. I started knitting my kids a couple of sweaters the first day of Lent one time. And I knitted the day and night for 40 days. Got through and found out I had 4 left sleeves. I don't read instructions. That's for those normsies out there. I started to knit a rug about 12 years ago. I got about a quarter of it done. It's still up in the cupboard. I start to clean my house, and I have to do everything, wash the windows, the walls, and do everything, or I just kind of let it go. I'm just compulsive, I guess. But I'm charming. I'm lovable. And I'm spiritual. And I'm sober. And I'm really a very nice person. Oh, I always say we got to do that again for him. Shall we do it for him? He's the one that did it all, not me. Oh. No human power can relieve alcoholism, but God could and would have sought. Now, how do you seek a God that you're so terrorized of? You know, I don't think it, if you're Catholic and Irish, it kind of helps. You don't have to, but I think kind of helps alcoholism. Everybody I talk to is either a Jew or a Catholic, and everybody, they are all scared death of God. I do a lot of work with Compulsive Overeaters Anonymous down in Southern California, and that's the Jewish disease. And alcoholism is a Gentile disease. And 90% of the people in OA are Jews, and 90% of the people in AA are Gentiles. But the Jews and the Catholics are the most terrorized of God. And it seems like those are the ones that are brought to me. Now, I was terrorized, too. It's too bad that it has to happen. I think God looks down on a Catholic who's been scared to death and kind of takes care of him. Boy, he better. Put all those priests down here to scare us today. He's going to have to take care of us, too, you know. So it came time for me to work the program, and I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. God, you know, when you're dying and bleeding to death on the floor, that's not hard. Your life's unmanageable. I had trouble with that. I get a few months sober, and then I'm going to go in there and drive my own car, you know, and smash up. And lately, and in the past several years, I see the first step this way. I am powerless over alcohol, my emotions, the lust of my flesh, cigarettes, my job, my car, whatever I'm powerless over. And my life's unmanageable, thank God. Oh, thank God. Do you know what a relief it is not to have to manage this thing anymore? Now, I won't tell you I don't, because that'd be a lie, and this is an honest program. But most of the time, I stay out of the management. He's done such a magnificent job when I'm just the little office girl and he's the boss. I just report for duty. What do you want me to do today, Lord? And he's just doing great when he does it that way. And my life's become smoother and easier since he's taken over. Now, come to believe that God can restore me to sanity was not hard for me. Because I thought I was crazy, too. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought I was nuts. Well, I was both. But the word sanity, if you look in the dictionary, says sound reasoning. How many of you think you've been in sound reasoning? We've been insane most of our life. So we come to believe that God can restore us to sound reasoning. You and I are sick in the feelings, love. And our feelings are liars. They have no heads. And we're always out of the feelings. We always say, I felt, I feel. You don't say, I think, I know. The Bible says, come, let us reason together. It also says, be healed by the renewing of your mind. And I like that. And I believe that I can't do it, but I believe that a power greater than myself that I call God can restore me to sanity. Now listen to the word restore. It means somewhere along the line, I had some sanity. Chern Hill was a long way back, I'll tell you that. But I think children have reasoning powers. Take a child and they watch its mother's mouth or a father's mouth, and all of a sudden it learns how to speak. And then it watches people walk, and it finally puts one foot in front of the other. So they reason this out. And then they go to school and they reason out that 2 and 2 make 4. All this is reasoning. I don't know where we lost the reasoning power, but somewhere along the line we lost it. So God can restore us to sanity or sound reasoning. Thank God, because then we can reason these things out. Now, the third step came along, and I was absolutely, totally stopped right there, because I couldn't turn my life and my will over to a higher power that was going to grab me by the hair of the head and put me in a pit and burn me forever. It's impossible. This God was like my mother. This God had favoritism. This God answered some people's prayers and not others. This God did not like me. Like everybody else, didn't like me, never did anything for me. Now, if I turn my life and my will over to him, then I have actually let him come in, and he's going to zap me. So I went to my sponsor, and I said, I can't work the third step. And she said, why not? And I said, because I'm afraid of God. She said, well, tell me about God. So I started telling her about him, and she said, oh, my Lord, stop. I'm afraid of him, too. Let's run. She said, you're going to have to find a new God, Dottie. Well, that's like holding your breath for 45 minutes. Now, I'm going to take you back a little bit and tell you that I was born and raised Roman Catholic. I'm not talking against the Catholic Church. I don't believe in that. I'm talking about a personality. And I had the unfortunate privilege of being raised by a practicing alcoholic priest. Hey, there ain't anything worse than that. There just isn't anything worse. The sober ones are bad enough, but boy, you get an alcoholic one, and that's really bad. Now, this man was a sick, very sick man, and he used to you know, go through all this ritual. We'd have to put our palms and our fingertips just so. We'd have to have our nose on the end of our finger. He had a book with an elastic band on it, and he'd hit that band. You'd all have to kneel at the same time. God help if you didn't. Hit that band, you all had to stand up at the same time. You had to say thee and thou. I was so mixed up with the thees and thous, I didn't know what I was praying for when I got through. But at any rate, because I was in the impossible position of this older sister and the younger sister, my little sick mind says, I know what I'll do. I'll run away and get married and get out of this situation. So when I was 16 years old, I ran away and married a boy 17 who didn't have a job. I was going to run away from my mother. We ended up living with my mother. You know, I'm not very smart. 2 months after I'm married to this young man, I'm pregnant. And, of course, he was a very young man and didn't want this child. And I can understand it. So the marriage didn't last. I went ahead and had the baby. And she no more jumped out of the womb than I was praying for God for her to grow up and get out of my hair. I was terrorized of her. And I didn't have to leave this young man. I just kicked him out because I was home with my mother. I didn't have to leave. I just kicked him out. Now, I had gone with a boy by the name of Al. When I was 14, he was 17 in real high school. And he had left and gone down to California during the Depression. And he came back during this time. And so now I had another goal. You know, I'm going to marry Al and everything's going to be fine. But I was outside wheeling the baby up and down. Now, my grandfather built the St. Thomas Aquinas Cathedral. And we lived right across the alley on Stevenson Street. And the priest was outside walking up and down reading his office one day. And I'm outside wheeling the baby. He comes over to me and he said, when are you going to have your baby baptized? I'm so bright. I said, not until I get married again. Can you imagine telling a priest that? And so he says to me, you can't get married again. And I said, well, I'm going to. He said, if you do, you'll be living in adultery, and any child that is, she'll be illegitimate. And I said, I don't care. I'm going to get married. And he pointed his finger at me, and he said, you are excommunicated. Well, you know, the priest was God. So God said to me, you're excommunicated. Now, my family didn't investigate it, and I didn't investigate it. So for the next 19 years, I wandered the face of this earth like a lost soul. Positive I was going to burn in hell. Positive that I would never have a chance. Al and I get married. We have a daughter, and my daughter's sick for the first 7 years of her life. Oh, loved ones, do you know how many times I went to funerals in my mind? You know how many times this child was killed by God to punish me? How many funerals I went to? There used to be a mortuary called O'Brien's on 2nd Street. I used to go over to that mortuary in my mind and pick out a little white casket and little gold shoes and little pink dress. And I milked this neurotic, morbid imagination until it almost set me insane. Oh, thank God for alcohol. Do you know what would have happened to me had I not found a narcotic to ease my pain called alcohol? Sure you do. You're alcoholics. Those people out there don't understand it. But you know what we do when that pain's so great you can't stand it and the terror's so great? And so Sandy's sick for 7 years and the doctors tell me we're not going to ever raise her to grow up. She has high allergies. Totally allergic. Didn't have any antibiotics and any antihistamines in those days. And she was allergic to everything. Put her down on the floor. She'd pick up an allergy. She'd have bronchial pneumonia. We didn't expect her to live. And I was terrorized. And I drank more. And I drank more. And I drank more. Now, how am I going to, all of a sudden, get rid of this crazy old god that's up there on a cloud, keep the set of books with that long beard and that white gown, glowering over there at me saying, one more and you've had it. I was sure that's what was going to happen. How can I possibly, dear ones, make a decision to turn my life and my will over to that kind of a god? Can't do it. Well, I went to North Hollywood. The only place I've ever gone for answers and the only place I've ever found answers is with you. They say you seek, you'll find. If you knock, it'll be opened unto you. So I went to AA. And the first thing I said to the first man I met that night, how do you believe in God? He said, you mean the old man upstairs? Oh, my God, that's blasphemy. You don't talk about God like that. You've got to say thee and thou. So I left him quick. Went over and talked to the other person. How do you believe in God? You mean my pal Joe? Oh, my God, we're all going to go straight down to hell, you know, talking like that. And I'm going around asking somebody, and they're telling me all these things. And finally a man said to me, hey, come here. And he pulled me aside, and he said, Dottie, you're going to drive yourself crazy. He said, do you really want to find God? I said, with all my heart. Oh, God bless that man, because he said to me, and he puts a lump on my throat, pray this prayer for 1 week, Dottie. No other. Promise? Promise. He said, you say, God, reveal yourself to me as you really are. No other prayer. And start looking. Oh, I bet I've told 1,000 people or more this prayer. I've never had one person come back to me and tell me it didn't work. So I start praying, God, reveal yourself to me as you really are. First thing I saw was that I had tunnel vision, I guess, all my life. I'd always looked right out and saw what was in front of me. And it was like somebody cleaned my glasses, and all of a sudden I could see things. And the world got bigger and brighter and lighter, and this was only in a couple of days. I went to a meeting shortly after that, and a man said, if you're having trouble finding God, take the word good and take one O out of it, and you have God. Anything that's good is of God. He said, now if you go outside tomorrow, and the sun's hot, you're not surprised. You don't say, gee, the sun's cold today. He said, why don't you say the sun's cold? Because the sun can't be cold. The sun by his very nature is a hot thing. It is always hot. God by his very nature cannot be good and bad. He is always good. Oh, that was so comforting. So I went home thinking about this. Now, I think we all have favorites in AA. So I started going around following a man all over Southern California. Loved him, adored him, didn't understand what the hell he was talking about, but just felt good sitting and listening to him. He was what we called a spiritual speaker, whatever the hell that is. But I thought, got to go hear him. So I went to hear him this during this week that I'm praying this prayer. He talked on a subject he'd never talked on before or since. He talked about the prodigal son. Now, I've heard the prodigal son story forever. He said, tonight I'm going to tell you the prodigal son in kind of an AA jargon. He said, you know, once there was a young kid who went to his father. He wanted to have his inheritance. Didn't want to wait for the old man to kick the bucket. So the father very weepingly gave it to him. And he said he got on a horse and he went to a far country and he spent it on wine, women, and song. He said, I think he was an alcoholic. Never heard that before. Now, he ended up totally bankrupt, and there was a famine in the country at that time. And he had nothing to eat, no substance, nothing. So he went to the pig master, and he said to the pig master, can I feed the pigs? Will you give me some money or something, some substance, if I feed the pigs? And he said, yeah, feed the pigs and you can eat what's left over. Now, he said, this was a deplorable state for this guy to be in. This kid was a Jew, and he ended up in the pig pen with the pigs eating corn husks. Worst deplorable state he could be in. So he's in there eating on the corn husk, and he thinks to himself, his father treats servants better than this. He gives him a clean bed of straw and something to eat. He knew he'd lost the right to be a son, but he could be a servant. So he said he got up and he shuffled and he stumbled home to the father. Now, I said the father was working out in the field, and he saw him a long way off. And he dropped everything he was doing and he ran to greet him, and he put a cloak on his shoulder. Now, he said the kid stunk. He'd been in the pig pen. He didn't tell him to go in and shower and get cleaned up, and maybe he was good, he'd take him back. And how like the alcoholic? How many times have you held somebody's head that was vomiting, that hadn't bathed in a long time, and you loved him so much? The prodigal son is really the story of you and I. And so he just put the cloak on his shoulder and a ring of acceptance on his finger. Now, he said the kid tried to tell him all the rotten things he had done. He didn't tell him to go out in the back party and cultivate the land for 30 days in penance. He said, it is enough that my son was lost and now he's found, that he was dead and now he's alive. And there was great celebration and the killing of the fatted calf over one son who'd been lost and now returned. And on the way home, I thought, surely to God, I'm a prodigal child. I had gone to AA and I had claimed my inheritance. And I turned it away. I ended up on my own front room floor, my own pig pen, vomiting blood. Maybe all I had to do was quit out there asking you people, how do you believe in God? How do you believe in God? And just shuffle up these steps the best of my ability. And maybe the Father would see me a long way off and come to greet me. And you know that he did. Now, I had some hang-ups because my mother was a dominating female. My father was a loving man, but I don't remember much about him because he was just there. He's kind of like a faceless figure. And I had a hard time trying to identify with a father figure. I could identify with a mother God, but, oh, spare me that, you know. I didn't want that. And so I started to pray and ask God to reveal to me if this was too familiar. Was I being blasphemous in order to have call him a father? Well, you know, today in this convention has been such a delight because of all the people that are here, I was brought back together again with a woman that I was raised next door to. We lived together and went to school together and played together. And her mother died when she was a very young woman, and she was raised, a very young girl, she was raised by a grandfather and a grandmother. Now, I'm sure she doesn't even know this story, but she used to call her grandfather Daddy Dick. And Daddy Dick was a kind old man, and I was over to her house playing more than I was home many times. And a couple, three times, this old man kind of grabbed me, put his arm around me, and he'd say to me, you know, if you ever need anything, Dottie, just ask Daddy Dick. Kindest old man I've ever known, till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The only one who really cared, I think. Well, I hadn't thought about this man in how many years since I was a child. And while I'm going through this week of praying, God, reveal yourself to me as you really are, out of my memory bank popped the thought of Daddy Dick. And I thought, maybe I could have a Daddy God. Maybe I could climb up in the lap of Daddy God and lay my head on his shoulder. He would say to me, you know, Dottie, If you ever need anything, just ask Daddy God. And so from that day on, I've had a Daddy God. Now, the very last day of the 7 days of praying the prayer, God, reveal yourself to me as you really are, I opened the Bible. My sponsor used to say, open the Bible or open the A book. Put your finger down and start to read. I thought this is a spiritual thing, so I'll open the Bible. I opened the Bible, put my finger down, and I read these words. You who are human parents, full of sin, if your children ask you for a piece of bread, would you give them a stone? If they ask you for a fish, would you give them a serpent? How much more will your Heavenly Father grant to those who believe in Him? It was just like he put a package and put the bow on the top of it. And from that day to this, I've had a Daddy God that is so wonderful. He's never lied to me, never mocked me. He's never threatened to burn me in hell forever. He's been closer than my breathing, nearer than my hands and feet. All of you this morning, take a big breath. That's how close God is. He's not up there on that silly cloud anymore, you know. He's closer than your breathing. He's nearer than your hands and feet. And He's walking with you always. The only thing that stops God from working in your and my life is us. He won't violate His laws. And he gave us the power to choose or reject Him. Now, honey, if you reject Him, He won't come near. He won't smash His way into your life, but He can. But if you choose Him, hang on to your hat, because He's going to come in. He's going to turn you around 180 degrees. He's going to give you peace and joy. The Bible says He came to bring us joy that we may have it more abundantly. He came to bring us life. And you and I have walked with our nose down to the ground thinking, if this is all there is to life, well, let's just break out the booze and have a ball. So I believe when you get well spiritually, that the physical and the emotional will follow. Direct quotes from my book. As you get well spiritually, the physical and the emotional will follow. And if you're not happy in AA, now this is my opinion, if you're not happy, if you aren't riding along, not finger-popping, jumping up and down happy, but serene with a quiet heart, search for your higher power. Pick up the missing link, because it's the only thing I think that's going to make the whole package clean for you. You will then become a total human being. I firmly believe this. The things that my higher power that I choose and love to call God has done for me since I've been sober are absolutely miraculous. See, we're all miracles in here. Do you know how many people are called and how many few are chosen? You people here in this meeting this morning are chosen. You're chosen people. Why aren't you out there strapped down someplace? Why aren't you out there locked up someplace? Why aren't you 6 feet under like my sister? Why aren't you? Why aren't you downstairs saying, this is a ball? They look like puppets. I shouldn't take the drink to pull the plug. My God. You know, those people downstairs, they don't even know there's anything wrong with them. They're saying, there's nothing wrong with me, wrong with me, wrong with me, wrong with me. I swear. You and I know there's something wrong, and we have a chance. Oh, we are so blessed. I wish you'd know that. Well, a lot of things went down when I got sober. If I'd have come in today and you'd told me all these things were going to happen, I'd have said, screw you, and I'd have gone out and got drunk. First thing that went down is I got the notice that my sister died. I would send her AA literature. She'd call me a religious fanatic, and she'd throw it away. And my mother would say to me, honey, don't send her that stuff anymore. All you're doing is upsetting her. And my mother and my brother-in-law aided and abetted in my sister's death, and she died. Blew apart. Now, I had to come home to an Irish wake funeral. You know what that's like, don't you, Annie? Everybody gets stoned. My sister's head is swelled to the size of both shoulders. Her stomach swelled like she's 9 months pregnant in the casket. And everybody gets drunk. That's the way they do in the Irish Catholic religion. My mother got so drunk she fell off a chair. But I'll tell you what you guys did for me. You sent me home with the serenity prayer. Had an old man come to visit me, crippled with arthritis, member of AA, and he said, Dottie, I'm going to give you the serenity prayer to take home to your funeral. I said, oh, Ken, I know the serenity prayer. He said, yeah, but not the way I'm going to give it to you, honey. He said, you go home to that funeral and you say it this way. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change today. Grant me the courage to change the things I can today. Grant me the wisdom to know the difference today. And you know, that's a beautiful way of saying the prayer, because I can accept today what I can't accept for a lifetime. I can change something today and it'll flop back the same way tomorrow. And I stood there looking at my sister in the casket. And I thought, the script is wrong. Something's wrong. My talented sister, she should be up here looking at me, and old dumb Dottie should be in that casket. What was it? And God revealed to me that my sister kept on fighting, and she died. I surrendered and I won. I went back to California after the funeral. The next thing that went down is my oldest daughter became a full-blown addict and alcoholic, and she's smashing her life away. She's married with a small baby. Half the time I don't know where she is. She's married, going through marriage and divorces. Finally, when my grandson was 10 years old, I was forced beyond my will to take my grandson from her. He was sucking his thumb and wet in the bed. His toes had, nails had grown to the top of his toes. His heels are split and bleeding, and he's the product of an alcoholic addict family. And so I had to kidnap him. I'll never forget the motion picture, Mary Poppins will live to be 1,000 years old. I sat in the Grauman's Chinese Theater through 5 showings of that to stay out of sight so I wouldn't be arrested for kidnapping that boy till we get the papers for guardianship. So the following Monday, the sheriff served my daughter with guardianship papers. And she was so stoned, she doesn't even remember signing the papers, and he told me later that her signature was practically unreadable. And when she signed those papers and signed her boy away, she walked out of her apartment and she left everything. She left her personal belongings, her furniture, her clothes, and disappeared off the face of this earth. Well, dear ones, if you don't think that's a hard thing to go through, I got news for you. If there's any people in here, if you have Al-Anon in Reno, and I hope you do, I salute the Al-Anon family program to save my sanity. And I spoon-fed my grandson little bits of this program. He finally stopped wetting his bed and sucking his thumb and started getting fixed up and better. And you know, it's amazing. When you spoon-feed children the program, if you have children, you're sober now, start giving them little spoonfuls of AA. Start where they're little now and start to give them something so when they grow up, they've got something to hang on to. My grandson was a pathological liar. I wonder how I knew that. And he'd come home from school and he'd be late and he'd tell me some crazy tale about how he'd beat these kids up and they'd taken his bicycle and all this, and I knew what he was doing. So I said to him, you know, honey, tell me the stories. They're wonderful. I love to hear them. But be sure and tell me that it's a story. And I told him about pathological lying and what damage it could do, because that was one of my biggest defects with pathological lying and exaggerating, and I had to work so hard on it. So I went to school to the teacher after he'd been there a short time, and I said, how's Greg doing? And she said, well, Mrs. Shore, he did something that I've never seen done before in school. And I thought, oh, my God, he raped a girl in the restroom. But he wasn't, no. She said, you know, he's very athletically inclined, and usually when the recess bell rings, he's the first one outside. But she said, just before we had recess, we were talking about Washington, D.C. He raised his hand, and he told about going to the White House and walking in the Rose Garden with the president. And he told this beautiful story about all about what he had done. But when the bell rang after it was over, all the kids ran out, and he stayed. And he kind of hemmed and hawed around the desk, and he came over and he said, Mrs. Burton, you remember the story I just told you about the White House? And she said, yeah. He said, well, I'm a pathological liar, but I'm working on it. Oh, my. Then I tried to teach him about what you plant, you'll reap. You know, the Bible says God will not be mocked. Whatsoever man plants, therefore shall he reap. AA says what goes around comes around. And we think we can get by with that. But I'll tell you this, if you lie, you're going to be lied to. If you steal, you're going to be stolen from, because once you work this program, you got to play it straight. So I was telling him, you know, he was always hitting kids and calling them names and everything. And I kept telling him, I said, Greg, what you plant, you reap. Now stop it. You start being good and kind to people, and they'll do it to you. So old philosopher me, you know, I'm teaching my grandson how to be a good man. So I took him to school, to the store, to buy some clothes to put him in school. He didn't have any. And typically, grandmother, like, overcompensated. Bought him everything he wanted. And he's just a little tiny guy, and he's got big brown eyes and blonde hair, and he wanted to carry all these packages. And I said, honey, you can't do this. Oh, let me try. So here he is, just weighed down with these packages, walking out, and we get to the door, and he looks at that, and he said, Grandma, I must have been planting something great, because I sure reaped tonight, didn't I? It was a joy. It was truly a joy to take care of this kid. And so then it comes along, and a long time goes by, and I'm not hearing a word from my daughter. But I'm trying to accept what I can't change. Well, I picked up an emotionally induced illness. I would wake up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning like I had a pillow over my face, gasping. I couldn't get my breath. And so I thought, well, I better get the doctor. So I go to the doctor, and he examines me, and he says, Dottie, there's nothing wrong with you physically. He said, this is an emotional thing. You better get yourself to a psychiatrist. Oh, how dare he? I've been sober all this time. I know all about me. So anyway, I was working with a girl whose husband was an Episcopal priest and loved Father Ken. So I dropped over to his office that afternoon, and I said, Father Ken, what do you think's wrong with me? And I explained what was going on, and he said, Dottie, I think you're in a panic. What are you afraid of? I said, I'm afraid I'll never see Ann alive again. And he said, you'll have to accept the fact you may never see her alive again. And in my anguish, I cried, but I can't. Don't you understand? I can't accept that. He said, then go on fighting. Again, that statement from the book, we cease to fight everything and everybody, including alcohol. I never give up any fight except alcohol. I went home that afternoon, I got down on my knees, and I said something like this. All right, Lord, I don't understand how this can be your will. But if it is your will that I never see Ann alive again, please just give me the serenity to go through it. And the load fell off my shoulders. And I got up and I could breathe deep for the first time in a long time. And that night I went to bed and I slept all night without waking up. No smothering. The next noon the phone rang. And it was my daughter. Isn't that odd? That's God. Now she didn't get well right away. But at least it was like God saying, hey, I'm in charge. Hang in there. I wanted to bring her home and I couldn't. I wanted to do so much to help her and I can't. Please remember, dear ones, you can't help your own. Oh, we know all about it. How many babies do you think I've worked with in all these years? How many people have I said a couple of words to, and they've gotten sober? And my own daughter I try to help, and everything I say is wrong. I'm Mama, don't you understand? I'm Mama, that's Mama talking. You know the old saying, please, Mama, I'd rather do it myself? Boy, that came from an alcoholic that had to. She didn't want no part of this. Well, I have to tell you that she did get sober, thank God. And my daughter, I have to hasten, because sometimes I forget. She's now clean and sober on the EE program 14 years. Thank God for that. Thank God. We got together shortly after she got sober, and we started comparing things, and I told her how upset I was and how I'd been praying. And the day that I went home and got on my knees and said, all right, Lord, I don't understand how it can be your will, but I surrender Ann even unto death. Just give me the strength. Was the day she'd gone to Tijuana, Mexico to get her drugs. Now, you could go into Tijuana and go up to the drugstore counter, and you can ask for 1,000 Secanol, and Nembutal, anything you want. And they sold it without prescription. But the Hell's Angel had been picked up coming across the border. So when she went in this time to get her drugs, they closed it down tight. They didn't know what the hell she was talking about. Now, it's not like going to another liquor store. The supply is cut off. And my daughter's burned out. You think I looked bad? My daughter's about 5'7". She weighed 72 pounds. She looked like a skeleton with skin, parchment stretched across her skin. She came back into the valley, and she lived in San Fernando Valley the whole time. And she's burned out, and she's tired. So she blocked all the doors and all the windows. She took an overdose of her drugs. She laid down, turned the gas on to die. And the very afternoon that I surrendered her, they turned the gas out for lack of payment. My God, don't you see? Don't you see if we get out of God's way what he'll do? I surrendered her to God, even unto death. And she turned the gas out to die. And they turned the gas out for lack of payment. Isn't that odd? That's God. I've had this happen 1,000 times. Too numerous to mention of when you get out of God's way, what a beautiful job he can do. We just stand between God and our problem. Here was Ann, here was Mama, and here was God. And when I got out of the way and they got together, man, did he do a job. Now, the next thing that happened is that I gave my grandson back to her because she had quite a little time of sobriety, and he became a full-blown alcoholic in less than 6 months, addict. And he's snatching his life away. And I'm thinking, my God, I grow these people around me like mushrooms. But his mother and his grandmother were attraction. In less than a year, he joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a grandson now that's 7 years clean and sober on the AA program. How marvelous. Isn't that marvelous? 3 generations, and we're sober now. The next thing that went down is that my husband went into business with an alcoholic partner. I begged him not to. He said, anybody that drinks too much, daughter, you think's an alcoholic. And I said, it takes one to know one. But he sold the house, he took our savings, and he went into business. And less than 9 months later, we're down the drain. Total bankruptcy. Business and personal bankruptcy. Walked out of the bankruptcy court with $7 and an old car. Lost everything. And we're not young people. But see, I had you people. I had Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew I could only sleep in one bed, eat one meal, and wear one dress. So I went back to work. But my husband didn't recover. He didn't have you. He didn't have what I have. And he became partly comatose. He sat and stared at the wall for almost 2 weeks. Little by little, I motivated him to get back to work. And then once he picked up something that's even worse than what you and I have, and it's called compulsive working and compulsive sleeping. You know what a workaholic is? You know how they run instead of walk? How they work hours instead of working their normal time? And so he works and he sleeps, and that's all, and I stayed 8 years. I used to go to meetings, and he'd be asleep on the couch with his mouth wide open, not even undressing or showering. And I'd come back from a meeting, and he'd still be there. And it went on for about 8 years, and finally one night I went to a meeting and he was asleep on the couch. I came back, he was still in the same position. And I walked over and I came that close to smashing him in the face. And I thought, that's as far as I go. I've loved him too long to hate him, I can't stand it anymore. And so I walked away. And I was divorced after 33 years of marriage. Now, like I said, if I'd have got into AA and you told me all these things were going to happen, I couldn't have stood it. But the most amazing thing about not once during all this time did it ever occur to me that drinking make it better. If I can't handle these things sober, honey, I can't handle them drunk. But the most wonderful thing is that I'm never alone. You're there. Oh, maybe not the same faces. But see, you're Alcoholics Anonymous. You're my loved ones. You're my kinfolk. You're there, and you never left me. And you stayed with me. And everything has come out all right. It's all worked around. I'm a man's woman. I hate to be alone, but I'll not pick one. If God wants me to be alone, he'll give me the strength to go through it. In the meantime, I'm having a wonderful time. I'm a productive human being. I'm doing things I never thought I could do. I couldn't hold down a job. I couldn't drive a car. Couldn't arrange my hair. Couldn't buy a dress by myself. Couldn't do any of these things. I couldn't ride an elevator or an escalator. Every time I come up that escalator, it may not seem much to you, but when you can't put your foot on an escalator, and all of a sudden you get sober, and you're so busy yakking, you find yourself halfway up an escalator, and you want to yell, "Yahoo! I'm on an escalator!" Then you know that everything changes. It all becomes so much greater. It's just absolutely fantastic. Well, after I got sober 3 months, I went back to work in pharmacy, and I can do everything with prescription except dispense it. But it's awfully hard working and waiting on sick people. When 9 out of every 10 prescriptions will go across the counter for Valium or Librium, and you can't help these people, it's just too much. So I went into cosmetics and worked cosmetics for a few years. And I'm working in there and I'm thinking, gee, you know, when I get to be 65 years old, they can retire me. You can't live on Social Security. And I don't know anything else. So I went over to Hawaii 1 year to a convention. I was laying out there on that beautiful beach and I'm saying to God, Lord, is there any way that I can possibly get some kind of a education where I can do what I love to do the most, and that's help people? I hadn't the foggiest idea what I could do, but when I don't know what to do, it's easy to turn it over. So I turned it over to God, and I said, Lord, show me if there's a way. I came back from the convention in Hawaii, and one of my babies called me, and she said, Dottie, they're giving a course at UCLA, and I think you ought to go. And I said, fine, except I don't have any money. She says, you've done so much for me. Let me pay your tuition. I said, oh, I can't do that. She says, well, you'd do it for me, wouldn't you? And I said, yeah. She says, you can pay me back. So I went over. Now, I had, about this time, I had some 20 years of experience, practical experience in AA. Went to a counselor over there, and they filled me in on the courses that I needed. And I worked 40 hours a week, and I went to school for 3 years at night. And I walked out of there with my certificate. And I'm now in private practice. I'm a private counselor. Counseling on alcoholism, drug addiction, migraines, ulcers, spastic colitis, any emotionally induced illness. Set up my practice almost 6 years ago, doing the thing that I love to do more than anything else, and doing the thing I'm the best at. Fantastic. Oh, how great it is to go to bed at night and know that this world's a better place because you're here, instead of, oh my God, what a mess. What a waste. Now, to be asked to come and speak like this, and especially to come back to Reno, I wonder if you know. Do you really know what it means to be back in Reno? I left here totally defeated. I think the only friend I have left in Reno is Madeline. I was raised next to her. I don't know anybody in Reno. I was not friendly. I was sick. I was crazy. Come back here and have all these loved ones and all these kinfolks. I'll take Jean and my heart home for the rest of my life, and many of the rest of you. My cup runs over. There's no doubt about it. And it all happened because I was forced to my knees. I was forced beyond my will to come to a bunch of drunks. That gave me the only love and the only acceptance I've ever known in my lifetime. I love you so much. I love you from the bottom of my heart. Now, you know, we went up the cemetery yesterday, as I told you. And my sister's epitaph doesn't say Evelyn Singer, Evelyn Junior Champion, Evelyn Model, Evelyn Adored by Her Mother. You know what my mother said when she called me on the phone? Dottie, Evelyn died tonight. Thank God, it's over. I said, yeah, thank God, she's at rest. That's my sister's epitaph. We're all going to have one. What's yours going to be? Poor guy, he couldn't make it. Jean was telling me about a girl that died. Accidentally killed herself. Very few people at the funeral. Is that what's going to be like for you? Because we're going to have one day. And of course, you know, I'm so dramatic, you know, I had to figure out something really zinging for me. I thought, as long as I stay sober and I should die, my epitaph's going to read, Dottie, well done, O good and faithful servants, because I sure tried. And it can be that way for you. That man, what a great person he was. I'll never forget what he said to me. I'll never forget what she did. That's what we want to do, and we can have that. We're here for such a very short time. Let's make it count. Let's make it count for the alcoholic who gets sober. You know, so many times I've never been at loss for words. I'm sure you know that by now. But I would like to be able to say words differently than I say them my own way. And I finally had to get somebody else's words. And I found a poem by a man called George Eliot. And he says this, and it's the greatest and the closest thing I can come to tell you what you mean to me. And it says, "Oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of being safe with friends, of not having to weigh thoughts or measure words, but to pour them all out, chaff and grain together. Now the friends who love you will take it and sift it, will keep what is worth keeping, and with a breath of kindness they'll blow the rest away. So I ask you, dear ones, to take what I've said today that's worth keeping, and with a breath of kindness just blow the rest away. And please don't ever stop loving me. Thank you very much."